refundable too, in terms of change of investment, so you can see that.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Apologize for getting started late again. One of these days we're actually going to start at 1 o'clock, but not today. This is the House Committee on Revenue. Today is the 20th day of April. We welcome you. We've got scheduled for public hearings as well as some work sessions today, as well as an informational meeting. And so let's open today's meeting by having an information meeting. We'll open with an informational meeting. The chair appointed an ad hoc work group on low-income relief to report back to the committee on some discussion and findings that they had to bring us some kind of ideas, of the many ideas that we had relative to housing and rent relief and earned income credits and refundable credits versus other kinds of credits. So Representative Hass, Representative Galizio, and Representative Olson, I believe, were the members of that committee. So Representative Hass, Vice Chair Hass, please.
Thank you, Chair Butler. What we came to some consensus on was to sort of pool some of those bills we heard about, rent relief and housing and others, into the earned income credit bill. And there was a bill, House Bill 2046, that was a result of some interim work on this issue during last fall. And so that was a committee bill. We have drafted some amendments to take the current earned income tax credit, which is at 5%, and make it refundable, which is what the bill called for. And we built on that by increasing the 5% rate to 7.5%, and then the following year to increase that rate to 10%. And your encouragement, Mr. Chair, we were to start that at 2007, and it would phase in over those 3 years. You have the revenue impact sheet in your packet. Essentially, that is it. It makes the earned income tax credit refundable, and it raises the rate to 10%. And it goes a long way towards making our income tax system more progressive, particularly at the low end, helping mostly people who work in poverty wages and below. It's mostly a working poor tax break.
Representative Hass, just a question. There were a number of other issues on the table relative to rent refunds and renters credits, those kinds of things. And as you're aware, we're working other bills that deal with specialized credits for industries that provide low-income housing, affordable loans, and those kinds of things. Any discussion relative to the rents or the other ideas that have been brought forward by our colleagues?
Yes. We just felt that it was a difficult thing to administer, regulating and sending back rebate checks, refund checks to renters. A student at Willamette in a dorm room, or a single mother on welfare up in northeast Portland. I mean, how do you get the department to recognize where the equity is in those kinds of situations, roommates? And we just thought this is a cleaner way to help mostly the same people, especially because of the fact that this conforms to federal tax law and helps with the compliance, potential compliance problems. So that was the thinking.
Representative Galizio or Olson, comments, input?
I think Representative Hass, I don't have anything to add.
I like the idea from what we've shared a little bit, and Paul was, I mean, helped out quite a bit with the whole idea. The concept, too, along with that was, I mean, if you have individuals out there that are working, at whatever level, that they would receive this low-income break. I mean, so if you work, you get it. And that's just going to stimulate, for me personally, I think, it's going to help with self-esteem because we're trying to turn around and help them. But it's also going to be good for the economy as well.
So we come back to the working college student across the street. They're working and going to college. Would they be entitled to the credit the way that you've discussed it, or is it something that you considered relative to the, it's not income based, or it's not asset based, it's strictly based upon income. Is that?
I don't see why they wouldn't be eligible for that.
Okay. Okay. So it may address the student that's paying high housing costs across the street and working part-time at an $8 an hour job.
Or $7.25.
Or $7.25, and they could then be entitled to the earned income credit right. The way that you discussed it, which would be easier to administer than a rent relief for that same student sharing a dorm room or sharing other facilities. Representative Galizio?
No, I was just agreeing. Yes.
Oh, okay.
That was the college dorm, or the dorm, you know, the college student was I think the best example of as to why we went with straight the income.
Excellent.
I might point out, Mr. Chair, that while it's doubling the rate now to 10%, a lot of states are up at 20-25% for this tax credit.
So it's a good start. Did you examine any amounts higher than the 10%?
Well, Mr. Chair, we certainly looked at some tables, and the issue is how much can we afford, right. I guess.
Well, Oregon depends more upon their personal income tax, and consequently, I'm going to guess that when other states are at 25%, with income tax rates, you know, at a lesser rate perhaps than Oregon would be, then maybe a 10% graduate into a 10% at a high 9% marginal tax bracket, then it would probably. And I don't know how it fits in with the sales taxes and the other taxes those folks may pay in other states. Did you do any comparative with other states that had higher rates than 10%?
As to what their overall
what the overall burden may be with regard to sales tax.
We really did.
Okay. Okay. Further discussion from the work group. I thank you very much for doing this. I appreciate it. I appreciate the effort that's expended. Extend gratitude to staff as well. Paul, thank you very much for assisting us in that regard. We did have, there's been, as you're well aware, colleagues, there's been quite a number of bills that have come forward on this, and we worked that out. So with that, we'll go ahead and close the informational meeting relative to the low-income relief work group. And thank you for your report, and thank staff for your assistance. And let's just go right into 2046. We'll open a public hearing on 2046 and invite, thank you, Paul, and invite Elizabeth Martin Mahar, if you'd like to come forward, Elizabeth.
Chairman Butler and committee members, with House Bill 2046, you've just heard about the Dash 1 amendments, but that's what you have in front of you. So it is phasing in an increase in that percentage of the federal earned income tax credit for Oregon's earned income tax credit. And it's changing Oregon's earned income tax credit to be refundable. And again, that's a big policy change, because right now, if taxpayers do not have tax liability, then they cannot use the full amount of the credit that they may be owed. So this would actually allow them to have rebates and get checks and stuff for the full amount of their total earned income tax credit. It's specifying that refundable tax credit equals 5% in tax year 2007, then it goes to 7.5% in tax year 2008, and then it goes to 10% in 2009 and beyond. And so you can see there from your revenue impact statement, it does grow and it increases. And I've got in here some feedback effects, because I ran the earned income tax credit in OTM with some other bills that we have today. So basically that's what you're seeing in the positive feedback effects. Again, once you're lowering the tax rate for any group, and particularly, you're hitting a lot of people in the earned income tax credit pool. There's like over 200,000 or something of taxpayers. I guess it was 170,000 taxpayers in 2003 who used this. So you are affecting a lot of people. Well, then when you reduce their tax liability, that means they have more spending power, so then they can consume more in the economy, and then that's what you're seeing with the feedback, the positive feedback effects there from the OTM model. So overall, with total static and dynamic effects, you've got a reduction there in 2007-08 of $6 million, in 2008-09, $12 million, and then 2009-10, $18 million, when it's up to that 10% level, and then in 2010-11, $17 million. And these are benched off, you know, as our economy grows, then we assume that fewer people will be qualifying for the earned income tax credit. So that's why you're seeing it go down slightly out there in those outer years.
So the static, so at 10%, the static amount continues to decrease because people are earning more and therefore qualifying for less earned income credit overall.
Yes, Chairman Butler, that's correct. And I benched it, marked it off of, we get returns and stuff. We get forecast returns in different income groups from our at each forecast. So this was benched off the March 2005 forecast, and then you know, from that, basically looking at what are the change then in those low income groups, and so that's why you see a reduction there slightly over time. Do you have any other questions? Do you want me to go through the Oregon tax incident stuff?
I'd like to know the impacts that you've, what the estimated feedback effects are from OTM. I mean, what's generating those?
So Chairman Butler, you know, I'll just start in with this table because I think it's, you know, at least a summary. You know, please realize that when you run a tax, a shock to the Orient tax incident model, I get about 5 pages of output. So, you know, this is a very small sample of the output that you can get out of OTM. So it's just a matter of what do you want to look at. And so I try to, you know, to pull out a few key things to look at and then to compare across different tax policy changes. So in terms of the refundable EIC, you don't see the first line there. I've got the comparison criteria, and the first one there is positive feedback. Well, that just tells you how much additional revenue, positive revenue, because these are all tax cuts. So the amount of positive additional revenue, corporate revenue, personal income tax revenue, payroll taxes. I mean, we've got a whole slew of different government revenue variables in OTM. So all of them are once you start shocking the system and changing it, then you're going to have some positive feedback effects from this. So with the refundable EIC, you can see there that basically it had a 10% positive feedback effect. Of the amount of static, 10% of that static revenue impact. So that's what then you see phased in over 5 years. So again, we don't assume that right away we're going to see all this positive feedback. We're going to assume that we have an equilibrium right now, and then 5 years later we're going to have a new equilibrium due to this policy change of having a higher earned income tax credit. So that's the first thing to look at. Then I looked at a change in investment divided by the net revenue impact. And so basically this is telling you that for $1 million revenue impact, for every $1 million in revenue loss, you're going to get $150,000 there in additional investment to the state. And then the next one there is a percentage change in labor, and that basically just says, given our total supply of labor, how much is that going to change? And that doesn't change very much, 0.02%, but it does have a positive effect on labor. And why is that? It's because you're making a tax credit makes Oregon seem more attractive. So what you have is in-migration to Oregon. And so what you see there, the last category there, the wage index goes down. So you're making wages and you're making labor cheaper. So that's what you're seeing then is then a positive impact because people, businesses want to hire more people, and so jobs are going to increase. So and I took the job change from the OTM right now is in $1997 dollars. So I brought all that. So for the job change, I brought that forward to 2006. And so we see a job change in 2006 employment numbers of 834. So that just kind of gives you a little bit of an understanding. I mean, this is not a job generating, policy change. That's not what the intent was, but just recognizing any type of a shock, any type of a policy where you're going to have a tax cut, you will be creating some jobs. It's just a magnitude of it. It really depends on the type of policy change that you make. And then you see there that the capital index goes up, because basically what you're doing is you're making wages cheaper and you're making it labor cheaper relative to capital, so capital index goes up slightly. Now, the interesting thing to look at is then as you move down there, you can see there's that table of the impact. And this really kind of helps you see a lot more, who's benefiting from this policy change. So on the, it's the last column there that says House Bill 2046-1, the EIC refundable tax credit. The static revenue impact is a reduction of $15 million. And the reason why this is $15 million, where I was showing you out in the outer years, it's about $20 million. It's because you have to move it back to 1997 dollars in order to shock the system. So you when you run OTAM, then we've got to move everything back to 97 dollars. So that's a policy tax change of $15 million, and then you have these positive revenue effects, so that dynamic revenue loss is $13 million. So basically about $2 million in additional revenue that's generated from that. But then when you look at where the benefits and the change in net household income, you can see that the majority of it is right down there in the low-income groups. The less than 14,525, and then the 14,525 to 21,225. So those two groups alone comprise over 60% of the revenue change for these household groups. When I go and I actually simulate this policy change, I really only use the first three income groups because of the limit that there is in current law on who can qualify for an earned income tax credit. But what you see then under the outer, the upper income groups are still benefiting from a tax cut like the earned income refundable tax credit. That's because there's a large group of people in this category. They can then go out and spend more, and then that brings additional bonuses and things to companies, which then can pay out to higher income folks. And so, all of it is fed through. So you see a positive feedback effect then in all these different income groups.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hass.
It sounds like kind of a trickle up.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's just important to recognize, that even though we are targeting certain income groups with the policy change, when you look at these feedback effects, they're going to have multiple effects throughout all different household income levels. So basically that's it with the earned income refundable tax credit. And I thought it was interesting to compare some of these with the investment tax credit, because that's much different policy change. Because in an investment tax credit, like we saw in 3355, you're going to be just targeting a particular input, and in this case, capital. So you're going to be making capital cheaper relative to labor. So that's the real policy change that you're making there. And what you see then is with an investment tax credit, it has great positive feedback effects. So the percentage change there is like 17%. So as far as, the amount of additional corporate revenue and then the additional corporate income that you'll be getting in the state is good at 17%. And then this change in investment is quite high too, of the three proposals here, of basically for a $1 million revenue reduction, you'd see $460,000 in additional gross investment in the state. But the job change is not as great as it is under a capital gains tax cut or even under this refundable EIC, because we are making capital now cheaper relative to labor. So you're making capital more attractive, so corporations and businesses are going to want to invest more in capital, not in labor. So it's just, it's important to recognize what you're doing in the economy and how that has an effect in which area. So if you're going to stimulate capital, then you're going to be stimulating additional making capital cheaper. That'll definitely give you some more positive feedback in the state. But as far as getting you additional jobs, that's what OTM tells you, is it doesn't really generate the jobs. And so what you see then are bigger tax cuts that affect more people, basically, are what you're seeing there in like a capital gains cut. And realize that these magnitudes are also, you know, I'm not in the capital gains cut. We have a static shock there of $147 million versus like an investment tax credit of only $27 million. So, you know, the shocks definitely have an impact in how much additional, job change that you're going to see in the state, as well as these positive feedback effects. So, but with a capital gains tax cut, what you're seeing in that type of a policy change is that it is going to make Oregon more attractive to people to come into the state. And so, again, you'll have this wage index falling, and that's what you see there. So the wage index under a capital gains is going down there. See, the percentage change is 0.2%. Now, it doesn't sound like a lot, but it is the biggest reduction of any of the three of the actual wage index. Now, you can see with an investment tax credit, since you're making capital cheaper versus labor, then you're causing your wage index to actually go up. So with an investment tax credit, that's really making wages, making labor more expensive, basically, relative to capital. So this basically kind of just helps you see a little bit about some of the, you know, there are trade-offs in every policy change that you're going to have. And really these distributional changes are what are kind of key, too, because you can see from these, like the first column there with House Bill 2574 or the House Bill 2332, you know, that distributional change and the capital gains tax cut is just about flipped from the EIC refundable tax credit. So the refundable EIC tax credit is really benefiting the low-income folks, and granted, there is some positive benefit in the other income groups, but the capital gains tax cut is just the opposite. The majority of that gain is in, above $126,000 and $173 income group. So they're having 73% of that positive change in net household income from that tax policy change, and the other income groups are benefiting, but it's just not at all to the same extent that you see in the EIC refundable tax credit. So they really are kind of opposite as far as who they're trying to target.
Elizabeth, do we know anything about the demographics of the jobs that are created? Are they, do we know anything? Number one, demographics with regard to age and family sizes, those kinds of things. Do we know anything about their relative earning capacity and their contribution to the ordinary income of the state from working?
Well, Chairman Butler, what I can do with OTM is I can get a distribution of, say, like the policy change on different sectors. Okay, so we have 28 different sectors in OTM. So I can see then, okay, what sectors are benefiting the most from, say, like an EIC, a lower income group tax cut versus a capital gains. And I didn't print that out, but I sure could. And then in there we can go in and look at, I've looked at average wages for different sectors for people. So you can look at it kind of that way if you wanted to.
But it wouldn't tell us whether they were bringing families into the schools.
Yeah, and Chairman Butler, what we have is an in-migration and out-migration type of an algorithm in the models to be able to simulate the population that's coming to Oregon. And so you do see population changes. I didn't include this on here. I probably should have, but, you know, basically when you're seeing these tax cuts, in particular with any type of a personal income tax change, you're seeing in migration to the state from that policy change. You're just making the state more attractive, so more people would want to come here because of the lower tax structure.
Okay. I just want to be sure we send a message to bring their capital when they come to work.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gleason.
I think I speak for the work group on the earned income tax credit. I think we see it more as a boost as opposed to a shock.
Okay, thank you, Representative. We have a number of folks signed up on each of these bills, and so let's do this. Representative Berger?
If you wouldn't mind, could I ask a question of
please.
Elizabeth? Elizabeth, I know you, sometimes I hesitate to ask questions because the answer I may not understand. Mm-hmm. And I know you went into, but why tax year 1997 on this form?
Okay. Just I know you were around Representative Berger when this first came about, but we started OTAM was enacted in the 99 session, and we first used it in the 2001 session. So, you know, that was a reference year at that particular time. So that was just the most recent available data that we had was in 1997. Now, we have more recent data, and we started to update it over the interim, but it didn't quite happen. There was a little boy who came.
Okay.
And it didn't quite get finished.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So really the base year we're using is 97.
Right.
Everything was adjusted up from that.
That's right.
All right, great. Thank you very much. In order to accommodate the three pages of folks we've got on these bills, I'm going to ask that you limit your testimony. We have had reports, so the first folks that we've got here on 2046, Patty Whitney Wise, Chuck Shelteroff, you know who he is. Shelteroff, that's it. And Ellen Lowe, if you folks will come forward, please. And I'm going to ask that you hold your testimony to about 3 minutes, please. Did you want to sign up? Please, Patty.
Yes, I'm Patty Whitney Wise with the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, and I thank you very much for bringing House Bill 2046 up for consideration. This is a measure that we have long been in support of. We work a lot with low-income families, and many of them struggle to put food on the table. This earned income tax credit really will help them with their basic living expenses. We're one of a few states that tax families making below poverty wages, and this will help lift many of those families out of poverty before they will actually have to pay state taxes. We believe strongly that a hardworking family should be able to afford housing and food and other basic necessities, and this bill moves us in that direction. I have included a fact sheet on the bill and the proposals that we heard today, and we are in full support. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Patty. Chuck?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chuck Shekatoff, Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. Good bill should pass.
Thank you.
Brief comments. In the 1990s, during the boom years in Oregon, the tax burden on the lowest income Oregonians went up, while the tax burden on the lowest on the highest income Oregonians went down. And there's a summary of that on the Oregon Center for Public Policy's web pages. And that's despite the implementation of the 5% non-refundable EIC. In our report, I just want to point to you a couple of things that will, I think, be of interest to you. We've calculated by legislative district the amount of federal EIC dollars that come into Oregon. It's one of the largest transfer payments into Oregon each year. And you'll see in the appendix by legislative district how much money is coming in and how many claimants within each district. On page 8, table 7 of the report has... as of a few weeks ago, the list of which states have refundable and non-refundable earned income credits and the level that they're set at. And also, as we've calculated in here, it would have to be at 12% to make so that a working family at poverty is not taxed on their income. And that's typically when people look at earned income credits and what level to set them. So a number of states, and I can provide the committee subsequent to the hearing, a number of states actually have a negative income tax because they have a refundable credit far in excess of their negative income tax for families at poverty, where Oregon, as Patty mentioned, is one of the minority of states that taxes the work effort of working poor. Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck. We are dealing with a refundable tax credit here.
Right. Yes. Yes. But
you say a number of states have it. That's what we're dealing with here.
That's right. But a number of states have a significant negative income tax for working poor family for families who are working who are still poor. Oregon is one of the minority of states that if you're working and you're poor, you still have an income tax. By setting it at only 10%, we think you would still have an income tax for some working poor families would have to be higher than 10%.
Better off paying California sales tax, is that what you're saying?
I didn't say that.
I want to make sure we understand that.
We're talking about, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we're talking about the tax on the work effort of Oregonians.
Okay, but, well, I'm concerned about the overall tax, and that's why I'd ask the members of the committee to report on that.
And if you'd like, Mr. Chairman, there's a study by the Institute on Taxation Economic Policy that does look at the overall tax burden of all the states. It's a couple years old now, but I'd be happy to put together a packet for you of all the states that have refundable earned income credits so you can compare that.
Was that available to our work group?
It probably isn't. It's a report that's on our webpage, and I'd be happy to pull the pages out for those states.
Why don't we get that so that we can use that as a reference on 2046. I'd like to have that because I think it's important that we compare all of the taxes that people are paying.
I understand that.
Thank you very much. Ellen Lowell, thank you, Ellen. You're gracious with your presence. We're always delighted to have you.
Thank you, Chair Butler and members of the committee. I'd like to begin by mentioning that, in fact, I think that Chuck Sheketoff and I were probably the two who testified back in, must have been maybe in 97 actually, on getting the capacity building that an OTM would do for analyzing revenue legislation. And I found the description that you just heard and I just heard absolutely fascinating in terms of the kind of assistance that's going to give you and really all Oregonians in looking at the level of fairness. When Chuck and I were at a meeting and first heard about the utilization of this kind of system in other states, we both realized that this would add tools to everybody's toolbox in terms of judging the fairness of revenue. I am here today as legislative advocate for the Oregon Food Bank and the Oregon Law Center. The Oregon Food Bank is the group that initially brought to the Housing Alliance the renter relief, which you heard, and that was the hearing then that led to the work of the work group. As a result of hearing what that recommendation would be, the Housing Alliance then did it. We polled the participants, and they agreed with the Oregon Food Bank that indeed for targeting relief, the earned income tax credit is, as a refundable one, is really the most efficient way to target relief to those who are most needy, but who are also part of the working Oregonian population. And so I need to say thank you to the work group and thank you to you, Chair Butler. We are very pleased to see what the proposal is, although I suppose I would be more ecstatic if it were beginning right now. And one of the first people I will call will be former Senate President Brady Adams, who actually was the one who assisted us initially in going with the non-refundable and advised me to have patience. And so, but we ended up losing it. Yes, he supported it refundability, and I'm glad that you have honored the commitment that he made so many years ago. Thank you very much,
Ellen. We appreciate you bringing these important issues and your proactive work that you've done through the years and looking out after us. The rest of us are still trying to catch up with you. We've got a ways to go. Thank you very much.
Appreciate your assistance.
Any questions of these three members? I'm hearing and seeing none. Thank you. And then Bob Castagna.
Thank you, Chair Butler, members of the committee. For the record, Robert J. Castagna, General Counsel, Executive Director of the Oregon Catholic Conference. I just wanted to say thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, work group members, for your excellent work in bringing this amendment and this proposal to the state that you find it in today. This is the latest chapter in a nearly 17-year discussion of this issue before the Oregon legislature. And if you in this legislature decide in your wisdom to proceed to enact 2046 and the governor signs it, you will have added another significant chapter to appreciating the working poor and alleviating their tax burden. And we say thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Well, we appreciate your advocacy on behalf of the working poor. Questions about? Thank you again. That's all of the folks that have signed up. I intend to go ahead and have the public hearings back-to-back on these bills, colleagues. So let's what I'm going to do now is open up, or we'll close the public hearing on 2046 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2332. Well, let's see. Let's do this. Let's start with 2574. Let's instead open. I beg your pardon. We'll open the public hearing on 2574. And because that's got the least number of amendments, I think. Is that right? It looks like it only has three amendments. So let's go ahead and start there.
Okay, Chairman Butler and committee members, with House Bill 2574, we've heard this bill before. This is the capital gains tax cut bill. And basically what you have in front of you is a -1, a -2, and a -3 by Representative Galizio. So, and these are also in House Bill 2332. So I haven't given you any revenue impacts for this particular bill on these three amendments because I've given them to you.
And these are identical on the next bill.
Identical to House Bill.
Can you go through those, and then that will deviate the next round?
That's right. So the -1 amendment, what this is doing is it provides a personal income tax exemption for just that first $2,000 of net capital gains income, and that's what you're seeing there in Sections 1 through 2. And just so you're clear, all these amendments are deleting the original bill. So you're starting a whole new bill. And so the first $2,000 of net capital gains is allowed an exemption. So there's a 0% tax rate on that. Then what it's doing is providing that same capital gains exemption for farm property. And so everyone's clear, under current law, farm property has a special capital gains tax rate of 5%. So this is allowing them to choose then, and obviously they probably choose the subtraction of 2,000 if that's all they had in net capital gains. But this is allowing them that opportunity to take this $2,000 exemption of their capital gains on farm property. And now this amendment is applying beginning on or after January 1st, 2006. And so this is just applying to personal income taxes also. It is not applying to corporations. So that's the Dash 1 amendment. Now, with the Dash 2 amendment, the only difference is that it is not a 0% tax rate. It's 4.5% on that first $2,000 of net capital gains income. So that's the only difference between the Dash 1 and the Dash 2. Then with the Dash 3, and this is something that Representative Glizio has done some research on, and basically looking at Colorado's capital gain subtraction. So they have a subtraction just for the amount of net capital gain that there is on Colorado gains. And so it's Colorado property and its stocks or ownership interest in entities that are located in Colorado. So this is taking that same concept. And in Colorado, they use this just in the years when they have a surplus, and this is one of the mechanisms in which they distribute their refunds then is through this capital gain subtraction. And so they give a complete exemption. But basically, with this amendment, the Dash 3, it's providing a personal income tax cut to 4.5% for certain capital gains. And then it's separating out that it has to be a net capital gain that's included in income tax, and the taxpayer must have held that asset for at least 5 continuous years. And then the capital gain has to be derived from either real or tangible personal property in the state of Oregon at the time of sale, or stocks or ownership interest in an entity located in Oregon. And then it's allowing the Department of Revenue to adopt rules for tracing then this net capital gains assets. So that's all Section 1 of the amendment. Then as you go along here, you see that it's allowing then again that same opportunity for the capital gains in farm property, so they can choose between a 5% tax rate or they can choose this the capital gains at 4.5% if they have a lot of this Oregon net capital gain. This is applying then to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2006. And then we have this same capital gains tax reduction for Oregon property and stocks of Oregon companies for corporate taxpayers. And again, we have the same restrictions. It has to be real or personal property in Oregon, and it has to be stock and ownership interest in an entity primarily in Oregon. And again, you know, definitions like primarily will be something the Department of Revenue rules would have to specify out, because it's not clearly stated in the bill. Then, so basically with the, now for some reason, and I don't know exactly why, but this amendment came out so that it's applying to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2010 for just the corporate component. And I don't know exactly why that came out that way, and I apologize, because I'm almost positive I didn't put it in that way. I don't know where 2010 came from, but I called council this morning, and they just didn't have time to get back to me before the meeting. But just so everyone's clear, these are the corporate portion starts in 2010, but the personal income one begins in January 1st, 2006.
President Glizio, would you like?
Yeah, let's be really clear on that last. I don't want any extra problems here. So. Can I just give you the big picture?
You don't represent any corporate workers in your.
Yeah, no. A lot of farmland. Anyway, can I just give the big picture thinking, because Elizabeth will be able, you know, to give all the details, but I just wanted to frame it in just kind of the bigger picture. What was going on when I introduce these amendments. On the first, on the Dash 1 amendment, I should say about a week ago I had a town hall in King City, part of King City. It's a retirement community in my district. And I asked, you know, what people thought of the capital gains tax cut just generally. And a lot of folks were wary. One woman stood up though and said, you know, I have some stock and I have held on to it for quite a bit of time, and I'm going to sell it because I need the money. And I think there are quite a few people in that position. And this woman admitted she wasn't, you know, in the top 1%. She wasn't a very wealthy, well-to-do person, but she didn't want to be penalized for holding on to this. So the idea with this one is, at the federal level, a lot of folks, arguably at the very top, the top sort of 1%, 2% of the population, have done quite well, as Mr. Shekhtov also pointed to. And today we're starting to look at folks, the lower socioeconomic status. This one, the Dash 1 amendment says, you know what, we have some revenue constraints in the state of Oregon right now. We have tremendous shortfalls and we have difficulty funding essential services. So although Elizabeth said this deletes the original bill, you could frame it like that, but I would say this is a capital gains tax cut, and that's what the attempt is here. But this is recognizing that we have constrained revenue, we have difficulty funding our essential services. So this says to sort of middle and maybe upper middle income people, or just people who had some stock, and that if they have net capital gains of $2,000, we should not tax that. So that's the idea behind the Dash 1 amendment.
Did you, by any chance, did you run any kind of or check how many returns that have capital gains? I think we said at one time there was like 200,000 returns that had capital gains. Did you do any array on that to find out how many had $2,000 and less?
No. Okay. I don't know if Liz.
Yeah, Chairman Butler, what I did is I ran our personal income tax calculator, which is based on a sample of returns, and on those sample of returns, then that's where I went and limited it to the first 2,000 and stuff. As far as, this affects most people, just the magnitude of it, So, yes, there were, at least 170,000 returns that were affected by it. But it's just when you're limiting it then to 2,000, some will, take the whole 2,000 and some will not.
And then, the primary idea was, instead of taking a revenue hit of a couple hundred million dollars on the outside, it's significantly less. That was key to the.
Okay.
And can I, second one is the same idea, it just cuts the tax rate in half from 9 to 4.5%. So even a. Same idea, but just if the revenue hit on the 0% capital gains is too much for you, it cuts in half. So the third, my favorite, with all due respect to Colorado, they have great skiing, and it's very beautiful. They have a terrible spending cap policy there, so it will nothing to do with that. But I thought they had a really intriguing capital gains package. On some of the testimony we heard with capital gains, there's an argument that this money will be reinvested in the economy and it'll stimulate the economy. And yet, I was not very satisfied, and everything that I've read, I don't see that necessarily that is the case. So Colorado has a plan where they say, yes, we'll give a capital gains tax cut, and what we focus it on property and stock and ownership in companies that are primarily based in the state. So the idea here is that we want people to invest in Oregon companies, Oregon-based companies, and buy property here, and to benefit from that, and perhaps even reinvest in the state of Oregon. So it attempts to incentivize that. Now, I'm not saying this is a sort of perfect vehicle to do that, but I do think it gets to the idea that what people are talking about with why we need a capital gains tax cut is we want to reinvest in Oregon. So that's what this is trying to do.
So to try and get companies that are primarily based or located in Oregon, and then I noticed that you've also included and incorporated the at least 5 continuous years of ownership, which follows California and Colorado.
Yeah.
Before they would for folks that sell property at 4 years and 9 months, no proration on that.
Not at this time, but that sounds like could be a friendly change there. I'd rather have people investing in Oregon-based companies and Oregon properties. So this is the idea behind this.
Okay. How about if we have them invest in Idaho Power, too, that serves Oregon? Okay.
I'll take the fifth on that one.
Okay, questions of staff or of Representative Galizio on these proffered amendments to House Bill 2574? Yes, Representative Olson?
Right, sir.
Did you have a question?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. Representative Boquist.
You're waving your hand. I'm.
No, no, no.
Okay. Representative Boquist.
Yes. Representative Boquist, you know, because the 2010 date for corporations on the -3 was incorrect, Representative Boquist wanted to know what date I would put, and I think that 2006 would be the date that I'd.
I think that's what we originally had talked about, yeah.
Okay.
Don't want to punish Oregon companies, so.
All right. Great.
And actually, and this does not help people who have property in Colorado. Just want to get that out of the way.
Or Idaho or California.
These are House Bill 2574 and House Bill 2332 deal with the same issues, and the folks who signed up for both of them are substantially identical. So I'm just going to go down the list and invite Lori Werner Whalen, OEA, Arthur Towers from SEIU, and again, Chuck Shelteroff to come forward, OCPP. And I'm first going to ask you, is your testimony any substantially different relative to the capital gains on 2574 versus 2332?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen from the Oregon Education Association. No.
Okay,
I'm testifying to both.
Fine. Please, Lori.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen from the Oregon Education Association, representing 43,000 members. I'm also the chair of the Oregon Revenue Coalition. At last count, we were up to 95 signees to our listserv for the our Yahoo website. You were getting both my written testimony and some research that I'm attaching that I felt was a good balance for some that you were given on March 14th when you first considered these two bills. But I'd like to give you the substantive points of that testimony for the record in any case. There have been, by my count, more than 150 revenue-reducing proposals introduced in this legislative session. Of those, these two bills, House Bill 23 and 2332 and 2574, are of those with legs the ones with the gravest revenue impact to the state of Oregon for the general fund. Now, we've heard and read the comments asserting a contrary view of that, but our trust remains with your Legislative Revenue Office, whose economic forecasting tools you have invested in and which have not to date led you astray. The Oregon tax incidence model cost the state over $177,000 to develop, and it was constructed by a bipartisan team which included representatives of the business community. I've done research on this topic by nationally respected economists who support the findings of the LRO and not of the rosier picture painted by Dr. Connerly's study that you all have in your file that was done for the Associated Oregon Industries Foundation. I've attached to my testimony a fact sheet as well as a research report that provides an example of such other perspectives. At the last hearing, a member of this committee asked, which advice to trust with respect to the overall revenue impact of these bills?
Lori, let me just do this. I'm going to open up the public hearing on 2332 at the same time.
Sure.
So that we have both of them, 2574 and 2332. That way your testimony will be reflected in both places because your testimony is offered on behalf of both of them. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To be short, our advice is that you trust your experts and their advice. Also at the last hearing, you may remember one of the bill's proponents offered a month of his legislative salary to the charity of OEA's choice if the rosy revenue-gaining projections should not come true. Well, I'd like to put on the record our acceptance of the Honorable Representative Bruin's bet and advise this committee that we've chosen the OEA Foundation as our charity. The foundation provides such things as eyeglasses and winter coats to children who can't afford them. And they stand by eagerly awaiting that $1,200 or so that will be offered to compensate for what we believe is going to be more than $300 million in lost revenue to the state of Oregon where one of these two bills implemented. Now, to the substance of the legislation. All kidding aside, our opposition to these bills is founded on several issues, and I will point out to you that I wrote this testimony prior to being in receipt of Lisbeth Martin Mahar's documents that you've received here at this committee, but I was apprised that the revenue impact after going through the OTIM device would be about 10 cents on the dollar. So I calculated based on the static revenue impact that you all received on March 14th what the full impact of the two bills would be in 09-11. So the comments I'll make are reflective of that math. We, of course, are very gravely concerned about the revenue impact. After the cuts are fully phased in, the dynamic feedback, the dynamic revenue losses are estimated to be between $300 and $320 million per biennium. The feedback effects of investments we acknowledge does exist, but as I said, about 10 cents on the dollar, not a dollar for dollar return, making it a revenue neutral proposition. The amount of money would buy the state's share of 20 days of school statewide, just to give you an idea of that money. And in the phase-in period up to that point, the capital gains tax giveaway would cost Oregon in full formula revenue equivalence, that's both the state and local share, 2.1 days of school in 07-08, 3.9 days in 08-09, 5.6 in 09-10, and 6.9 days in 2010-11. That was calculated assuming a 5% inflation per year. Our second objection is based in policy concerns about fairness. Why should income earned through the sweat of one's labor be taxed at a rate double of that of investors? Think about that. We think Oregonians would not support what amounts to a tax subsidy for investors paid by them, by workers. Given that most people's income and even their investments, their homes, their pensions, are not subject to capital gains taxation, they're not going to realize this windfall if enacted, but they will be forced to cope with the cuts to our system that Oregonians deem vital in health care, education, public safety, and so on. The proponents of this bill argue for a trickle-down economics benefit derived from investment stimulus alleged to be created by this tax giveaway. As I've told you, we don't believe it. But who's to say that the windfall will be reinvested in Oregon? Nothing in the bill does. There's nothing that reserves the tax cut for Oregon-only business development or asset acquisition. There's nothing to guarantee that a single job will be created inside our state's borders. You have to take it on faith. We ask you.
I question that, Lori, based upon the information that legislative revenue has given us. I mean, you're asking us to believe legislative revenue, and she's got 4,000 jobs created in that. So I don't know. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, fair point. As I said, I didn't have that OTIM report when I wrote this testimony, but I will tell you that the bill itself, if you read it, does not have any sideboards or parameters that requires that the jobs be created in Oregon, and that's what I was speaking to, not the hypothetical, but the actual language of the bill.
Thank you.
Okay. We ask you to base your decisions on proven data. And we also believe that if you're serious about moving one of these two bills, we would respectfully ask you to ensure that only Oregon investment is rewarded in this differential way, such as your amendment Representative Galizio brought forward, modeled on the Colorado plan. We would support that. Dr. Connolly's study goes to Lane.
Can I just ask a question about that? That's an interesting concept, and we've got a rather significant base of folks that live in the Portland area near Washington, and a rather significant base that lives in Oregon near California.
Mm-hmm.
So if I wanted to go ahead and dispose of my Oregon property and receive the benefits of income tax free on it by moving to Washington, or a 5-year reduction on all property, irregardless of whether it's Oregon or Washington or California, by moving to California, why wouldn't Oregonians consider doing that for 1 year if they really want to come back?
Mr. Chair, I can't speak to the incidence of every single investment decision made by every Oregonian, but I can tell you that the research I've read suggests that it is largely a myth, that is a phenomenon that is practiced in a very large and substantive way, and I think that there are other people on this panel who actually have that research and can speak to it when you get to them.
Okay, thank you, Laura.
All right. Where was I? All right. With respect to the issue of low-income Oregonians and their ability to realize a capital gains windfall from a tax cut, if it is this committee's position that they deserve special tax treatment. We could support that, too, and do support the amendments that were brought to you today, because especially if we can give that first $2,000 tax-free, I would characterize the combination of all of those amendments as a capital gains tax cut for the middle class that creates Oregon jobs, and it would be hard to imagine being against that. By the way, 25% of the windfall from a capital gains tax cut gets exported to Washington, D.C. because of the increased federal tax liability. So, you know, that's money that could remain in the state if you weren't to move this bill. Finally, we believe it's a tried-and-true tactic to sneak big tax cuts through by phasing them in over a period of years. I've been around this building about 15 years, and this isn't the first time I've seen it come through. But and I would also argue that at least $69 million of Oregon's current revenue shortfall is attributable to the chickens of legislatures past coming home to roost. We question the soundness of that policy choice, because if something is a good idea, do it now. If it's a bad idea, don't do it at all. Just because you know the train's coming doesn't mean it hurts less when it hits you. So planning does not enable us to downsize for the, I mean, particularly when what's at stake is vital services. Your choices, given your obligation to balance the budget, are simply to raise revenues through some other means or cut programs further. I think I've made it clear that we see this bill as a dramatic revenue loser that will hurt most Oregonians and help only a few. But I'd like to make one final point in this regard. You are soon to hear a bill, I think it's House Bill 3460, that is sponsored by the Speaker of the House, that would dedicate 50% of personal income tax revenue to K-12. That includes the capital gains. If you cut the capital gains tax in half, you're also taking money directly out of Oregon's classrooms if you pass this other bill. The two concepts don't mesh. It seems to me there's a policy decision here. We believe that Oregonians understand that this legislature is struggling to balance the state budget because of inadequate resources. It seems counterintuitive to us to pass tax cut after tax cut as a response to a revenue deficit. If the agreement in this building is, and I quote, I have a copy of that memorandum of understanding, $12.393 billion, no more and no less, how can big tax giveaways be said to conform to this promise? We believe that the very best investment you and your colleagues can make to the economic well-being of Oregonians is to fully fund public education from preschool through higher ed. An educated state will be a prosperous state. Please reject these capital gains tax cut bills and think instead of ways to recover revenue loss through 46 cents of income tax breaks for every income tax dollar you levy. At the very least, when you're in a hole, please stop digging. Thank you.
Thank you, Lori. Mr.
Towers? For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for Service Employees Local 503. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify in opposition to the two bills under consideration today. I want to add a lot of new information and really just echo Ms. Wilmer Whalen's comments. But as a union that represents nearly 35,000 workers, many of whom are low-wage workers, making $9 an hour, caring for the elderly and the disabled, barely making ends meet, whose health insurance is under attack right now, the idea of providing tax relief to the upper-income taxpayers in the state at the expense of the services that so many Oregonians rely on is something that the to our core, we just cannot support. We don't feel that it's right that folks whose income comes from a weekly paycheck would be taxed at a higher rate than those whose income is from investment. The sorts of services that we're looking at cutting right now are just unbelievable in terms of child welfare, in terms of senior services, just across the board, assisted living, public safety, corrections, the list goes on and on. And for y'all to be considering this is, again, just going to be a severe blow to those folks who rely on those services. And finally, I just want to point out that the balloon payment nature of this bill, these two bills, is an attack not just on Oregonians today, but on Oregonians for biennium to come, because if it's not going to fit into a balanced budget now, how can it fit into a balanced budget down the road? I urge you to to oppose this legislation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Towers. Mr. Shelteroff, you know what your name is.
Chuck? Chairman Butler and members of the committee, Chuck Sheketoff, Oregon Center for Public Policy. Took me a while, too. My son has a hyphenated last name, so I'm sure he has your condolences. I've distributed to the committee a memo that I prepared for Tim Nesbitt of the Oregon AFL-CIO. We asked the one of the leading scholars on capital gains taxes, Len Berman, the co-director of the Tax Policy Center, which is a joint venture of the Brookings Institute, it's being handed out now, and the Urban Institute, who's also a professor at Georgetown University, was Treasury Deputy Secretary for Tax Analysis, and was a senior analyst at the CBO, and he's the author of the book, The Labyrinth of Capital Gains Tax Policies, A Guide for the Perplexed. We asked him to look at the study that's been presented to the committee by Associated Oregon Industries and Mr. Bill Connerly, and I've attached to that memo to Mr. Nesbitt a copy of Mr. Berman's response to it. I will just highlight a few of my comments, because I think they speak for themselves. First, the Connerly AOI study does not distinguish between investments in Oregon or anywhere else in the world. If Oregon's income tax on capital gains is so bad for our economy, then why did Oregon's gross state product growth outpace the nation each year from 1988 through 2000? Between 1995 and 2000, Oregon was the fastest growing state for GSP with our current income tax on capital gains. There's absolutely no evidence that it impedes our economy. Some people have asked me, well, how does Mr. Connerly have this chart showing that those with incomes between 0 and 20,000 have an average of $5,600 of capital gains? The reason is he included the negative returns. CBNO and others, including us, don't include those when looking at the quintiles or whatnot, because people with negative returns have business losses and whatever that allow them to have negative AGI. They're often very wealthy people with investments. So that's why it's so out of sync. Regarding the sort of the myth that there's all this flood of people, there's certainly everybody knows people who've moved to Washington State or maybe even California where they have a higher capital gains tax. But the data, if you look at what Mr. Connerly doesn't look at, is the data of who's moving into the state from both Washington and other states, movements within the state, and the full nature of the people moving to Washington. We published a report in 2003, The Capital Gains Tax Burden Does Not Fly, where we looked at that data, and we showed, in general, that a significant percent of the movement to Clark County, 60%, is offset by migration from Clark County to Oregon. And we enjoy significant in-migration from other states. I noted in there, you know, after these bills were in the paper about a month ago, there was a day or two later, there was an article by the same reporter, I think, or it's a different reporter at the Oregonian, talking about housing prices up, and they're going up so much because wealthy people are moving to Oregon. These are people with capital gains income, okay, that Mr. Connerly's analysis ignores, but our housing prices don't. He also fails to account for, I think he fails to account, maybe I was missing it, what would happen when you lower the capital gains tax in Oregon? Of course, you're raising those people's federal income tax payments. Why should we be sending money to Washington, D.C.? We don't get a lot back when we can send the money to Salem where you can match it 2-to-1 with federal dollars and support Medicaid and other important programs.
But Chuck, using that example, I mean, tax rate at 100%, we wouldn't send anything to Washington, D.C. Let's do that. Is that what you're suggesting?
I think that's an example of a model going awry.
Yeah.
I just don't think that would work. So,
okay.
I'm not an extremist, Mr. Chairman. To the Berman memo, I just want to point out that Mr. Berman notes that Mr. Connerly's arguments are overstated or just outright wrong, and that other factors argue against a large differential between tax rates on capital gains and other income. In particular, he notes that a large differential, as proposed by Mr. Connerly in the legislation before you, would promote unproductive tax sheltering. And he includes in that, I would add, and I am a lawyer, that it's, you know, those lawyers spending time helping people figure out tax shelters is unproductive work by those lawyers as well. And that's what this would encourage. And I would urge you not to do that. He also points out that Mr. Connerly wrongly cites Mr. Berman's own research in support of his analysis. And when correcting that, he concludes, lowering the tax on capital gains will in fact lower revenues to Oregon. It won't raise them, as Mr. Connerly alleges wrongly citing Mr. Berman's analysis. And I would encourage you to read it, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Questions for these three panelists? Representative Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to have the same response to the same question from each of the three. If any or each of the amendments were substituted, is that something that you could then support this bill with?
Mr. Chair and Representative Riley, we would support the amendments.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, I have not had a chance to look at the amendments, but they, we seem favorable towards them. We'd be happy to get back to you in more detail on those.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Riley, members of the committee, not looked at the detailed language, but from the description, would not support the amendments. I just don't believe reducing capital gains tax has any impact, as the models may show or whatever. And as Ms. Lowe mentioned on the last bill, I was a big proponent of the tax incentives model and actually served on one of the advisory committees in developing it. But I think you have to, at a certain point, you have to sort of say a model's a model, and then there's reality. And so, for instance, on the earned income credit, I find it a little bit preposterous to think that all these people at high incomes, knowing that the credit ends at like $35,000, are going to see their income go up 7% or have this 7% increase. I think at a certain point, models get outside the realm of reality. And I just don't think that's going to happen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Further questions for these panelists?
Can I just clarify something?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I'm just so everyone's clear, too, on the table that I passed out and stuff, what the percentages are is not a percent of their income in that particular income group. It's the percent of the total income, household income change. So it's just looking at the total change for that particular change, policy change, and then just splitting it out by the different income groups. So it's not like, 7% of the above $126,000 is going to...
I appreciate that. I just don't see that income changes on those households from the tax. I realize money that they spend is... earned income credit is money that's spent in the economy, and it does work its way through the economy. I just don't think it's that significant.
Thank you very much, panelists. Bill Olson and Tim Nesbitt. And Tim, you're signed up first. Is Mr. Olson still here?
I don't see him anymore.
Okay. Tim, you're testifying on both 3223 and 2574. Is that correct?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You. For the record, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. I'll keep my comments brief, both because I was here about a month ago and because most of the preceding witnesses covered the points I wanted to cover. I am passing out a chart that I meant to pass out last time I was here that just gives you the latest snapshot we have from a national study showing the incidence of the all taxes, state and local, paid in Oregon by income groups. And I think it's worth keeping in mind when we talk about the equity or inequity of reducing taxes on investment profits. But the main point I wanted to make is that we urge you to use honest scoring when it comes to the revenue impact of this, both of these proposals. And that's just another way of saying we very much support the use of the findings as brought to you by your staff from the Oregon Tax Incidence Model. As Lori Wimmer-Whalen noted, we spent about $177,000 to develop that model. It was done with the oversight of a bipartisan committee. There were both Democratic and Republican members of this assembly represented, as well as business and labor. AOI was represented, as was labor, in the person of yours truly. So it was a significant effort, and I think it bears continued attention and respect as the kind of neutral arbiter or yardstick to use when it comes to projecting these revenue impacts. It's very much at odds with the findings presented to you by Mr. Connolly in his report for the AOI Foundation. But that's why I asked Mr. Sheketoff to prepare the critique of the Connolly report, which he's already delivered to you, which you have a copy of. So I would urge you to look at this proposal first in terms of its ultimate impact, amounting after all the feedback effects to $133 million a year. And if it takes us 5 years to get there, by projecting reasonable growth in inflation and population, our best guess is in that fifth year, that $133 million would otherwise be available to pay for almost a full week of school for every child in every grade, K through 12, in every school district of our state. That's the magnitude of the revenue impact as measured by the Oregon Tax Incidence Model. So then the question becomes, can we afford this? And under some rosy and hopeful projections, maybe you can hope we can. But we certainly couldn't afford it in the coming budget year. And to simply defer the implementation and offload this kind of revenue impact into future years, we think is irresponsible. You have a balanced budget requirement in the state constitution. I don't know how you balance the budget with this kind of an impact, this coming biennium. I don't know how you do it one or two bienniums hence. So we urge you to take another look at any and all bills that come to you that propose to enact tax reductions in future years when you can't square them with a balanced budget in the coming biennium. Secondly, look at the OTIM model's estimate of jobs produced by these bills. 4,128 jobs. Look at the revenue costs, $133 million. That amounts to $32,280 per job. Not a very cost-effective way of stimulating the economy and producing jobs, especially when the same model, the same economic model, tells you that these are going to be lower-paid jobs. Finally, we ask you again to consider the equity inherent in reducing taxes on investment profits while maintaining current tax rates on wages and pensions and distributions from IRAs and all those things that working families depend on during their working years and their retirement years. We don't think it's fair. We don't think it's good policy. We don't think it's affordable. And we strongly urge you not to move forward with these bills. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Ned? Representative Riley.
Yeah, same question as before. Would you support any of the three?
Well, the first two of the three amendments passed my first test, which is let's not postpone anything into future biennium. At least they take effect this coming biennium. My second caveat, not seeing the revenue impact, but actually if it was $1 million or 10, I'd have the same response, and that is I would support it on the condition that you have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and we can square it up with a balanced budget at 12.393.
Other questions? Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Manager.
Thank you.
And a referral to Ways and Means would be appropriate, colleagues, if we were creating a fiscal in this particular biennium, and that is one of the issues. These are not the proposal on much of what we're looking at today does not affect the current biennium. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir. Representative Pass?
On that note, I know we started on 2574 and then added 2332. But
we did.
There is an amendment on 2332 that we did not talk about that would start this in this biennium.
Exactly. Okay, and we will get to that. Okay. You're absolutely right, Representative. You do have an amendment proposed there. Mr. Link Cannon and Joe Schweinhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lincoln Cannon. I'm the Director of Forest Resources and Taxation for the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I do not have written testimony for you today. I didn't come prepared to testify, but when I saw the list of folks testifying on the bill, I thought somebody might at least offer some counterpoints. We have recently started to look seriously at this bill as it's come to the front within our membership. Oregon Forest Industries Council is essentially the industrial timberland owners of the state. Those are the people we represent. I have talked at some length to accountants and comptrollers at various types and sizes of memberships of firms within our membership, and there's a pretty unanimous support for what was 2457? 2574. And as I understand it, those will be amended to 2332 and implemented beginning in 2008. Those are the sets of amendments we support. I'm not sure what they are at this point, but that's what we would support. Relative to the question of whether or not people move out of state to avoid capital gains, I guess I have an anecdotal. There is, it's hard to study and it's hard to quantify, but I can tell you today I talked to an accountant at a major accounting firm who has some expertise in forestry taxes, and that's what I wanted to talk to him about, the capital gains impacts relative to forestry. And what he wanted to talk to me about was all of his clients who are moving to Vancouver. And he spent 5 minutes unsolicited telling me that it's not rocket science. If you're going to realize a large capital gain and you have a high capital gains rate, the higher the rate, the more likely you are to move somewhere else to avoid that. It's not a, it's made much more complicated than it needs to be. It's a pretty simple financial analysis, and the reality is it's happening. You just need to look across the river to see the condos and castles that they're building over there. So I would offer that from the perspective of someone who's on the inside and sees it happening. You also heard, I think, last time, you heard this bill from Mr. Lammers, Terry Lammers, who is a small woodland owner in the state, who essentially told you the same thing. He talked about Alaska and Washington in particular. But I think for large small woodland owners with large estates, it isn't rocket science. You know, some people may have other reasons. It's a factor that people consider. And for some people, it would be a deciding factor, and some it wouldn't. But it's certainly the higher the rate, the more likely that is. In terms of equity, I'm just going through a checklist of things I've kind of written down listening to the other testimony. With forestry in particular, one of the arguments is capital gains not only taxes income, but it taxes inflation. If you have an investment in place for a long period of time, you earn money on that investment, but you also have inflationary gains that aren't real income gains. They're just inflation. And in forestry in particular, and most of my comments are directed to timber harvesting activities and the revenues that result from that with regards to forestry. In the forestry enterprise, you invest money up front, you build roads, you plant trees, you do weed control, you do all these things to get a stand of trees to grow. You wait 50 years, and then you harvest it, and then you get income. A large part of that income is inflationary, and forestry probably, unlike most other, more so than most other enterprises, there's an inflationary factor to that that's getting taxed, and we don't think that's fair. Also, relative to, and I think you've heard this before, and it's in Dr. Connerly's report, but taxation of capital gains for corporations really amounts to double taxation, because corporations, taxes, any taxes on corporations are paid twice. The corporation pays them, and then the shareholders pay them again. So to the extent that you can reduce that burden or that inequity, I think that's a good thing that comes out of this bill.
I don't really think that the shareholders pay them again, because there's less money to pay them with. They pay some tax, but can't pay as much because there is as much left over.
Right. Well, but they, you know, what's left over, they do pay on.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. And this, my final point, and I will try to make this as brief and concise as possible. It's a very complicated issue, and it has to do with the changing nature of industrial forest land ownership in the state of Oregon and the different types of owners that we have in place and the tax implications of that and the investment implications and ownership implications. When I started with OFIC in 1992, all the industrial forest land in the state was owned by either large forest, integrated forest property companies, or a variety of different sized family and publicly held, primarily family entities. 15 years later, our membership in OFIC includes seven what we would term alternative investment organizations, five what are called TIMOs, timber investment management organizations, and two timber REITs, real estate investment trusts. These are both entities that look at forest land ownership not as part of an integrated activity, but as a financial investment vehicle, as part of a portfolio. Timberland is looked at as a stable, good long-term investment for in particular, institutional investors. This was pioneered by John Hancock Insurance Company back in the early 90s, and they were very successful, and it spread considerably. the reason I'm telling you this is these institutional investors are tax exempt. They don't pay taxes on income realized in Oregon. Similarly, REITs, the income realized by REITs is passed through to investors, so to the extent the investors in these REITs are not in the state of Oregon, they don't pay taxes. Whereas the folks that are left that own the land, live in Oregon, own the land in Oregon, they're paying a 9% tax on their gain when they sell their timber. These other entities pay no tax, essentially, in the state of Oregon. Like I said, it's gone from 0 acres in 1991 to over 1 million acres today. And we've recently seen, most recently, Boise Cascade lands have gone into that kind of an organization. Seen Georgia Pacific, some of IP's lands. I'm missing another big one, Crown Pacific. Those are all in these alternative investment vehicles now. So I guess my point is, we're talking about maybe the difference between 9% and 4.5%. One thing you need to consider is the difference between 4.5% and 0%. Because to the extent that the tax structure provides incentives and abilities for these alternative investment firms to buy Oregon forest lands, they're not going to pay anything. So maybe a 4.5% rate that encouraged retention of forest lands by Oregon forest land owners would be generate more tax than the alternative. I hope that's fairly clear, and I tried to be as short as I could in describing that, but that's kind of the point I wanted to get to.
I just would make this point in that regard, Link, that my concern is that that those nonprofit organizations that are investing in that forest land are probably doing so for the benefit of retirement accounts. And thus, anybody that makes that kind of money would be shifting it. No, they wouldn't be paying any capital gains. They would be shifting it over into individual income tax returns where we're getting a 9% bracket.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. But I, for example, and I'll use one that I think is already well known. I don't know who all these folks are, but CalPERS is certainly one investor. And they're not going to pay their recipients of those receipts except when they move to Oregon, aren't going to pay Oregon income tax. So the question is, who are the owners and who are the investors in these entities? And I would posit that for the most part, they are not Oregon residents. So to the extent that they are Oregon residents, your analysis is correct.
I was hoping you were going to tell me that John Hancock, I know that John Hancock had the teacher's retirements for quite some time, separate from PERS. The TSAs were run by John Hancock, so I was hoping you'd tell me that most of that was going to come back into Oregon as personal income tax from the good investments on our forest lands.
Well, and to the extent that Hancock is one of our members, and by the way, all these TMOs and REITs are members of OFIC, and I'm not here to say anything negative about those companies. I just want you to understand the dynamic that's going on there and the tax implications. Hancock is a member, and to the extent that they manage lands that are for retirees in Oregon, then those would be taxable at 9%. Well, they will be taxable at a capital gains rate, whatever that rate may be. Right now, it's the same as normal. So,
okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Joe?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Joe Schweinhardt, Associated Oregon Industries. I wanted to come up here and make a few comments. One of the reasons, and it's unfortunate that Dr. Connolly couldn't be here today to testify on some of the comments that were made about his study, but one of the things we tried to do in that long testimony I talked about last time was this isn't something that came up overnight. Cutting the capital gains is a proven through studies. It's proven through experiences in other states. It's proven through numbers both nationally and locally in different states that it does work. Why is it you think that a lot of states, and a lot of states that are successful, do not have a high capital gains rate? Because they don't see it as an incentive to getting business to the state. There are 10 states with zero capital gains. Some of those states are the most successful states in the nation. So there's a reason why this is being done. When you look at some of the numbers OTEM has, and I think legislative revenue staff will tell us that they can't always test for all these numbers. There's always hypotheses out there that for lowering capital gains that cannot be, they don't have the elasticity to really look at some of these numbers and see the real positive effect that it has. And these are numbers, frankly, that we're anticipating they're going to be greater than we can even test because of what it's going to do to our economy. Now, cutting the capital gains rate is going to set a foundation for the future of the state. It's one of the most important things you can look at for preparing the state for future economic well-being and prosperity. Is it fair? Yes, it's fair, because not only does it have cuts across the board for various people, but it also increases the economy, providing jobs. Everybody has a chance at those jobs. Those jobs provide revenue. It punishes the elderly, people that have worked all their life, now want to cash in on that hard work. They're paying a penalty. Global competitiveness. A lot of nations across the world are cutting their taxes, not necessarily capital gains, but cutting their taxes because they realize the global economy is here and that we have to help. We have to be prepared to take on that competitive nature we have to do. Cost per job. Dr. Connolly found that those cost per job is about $321 a job. Now, I know we can probably take 20, 25 different studies and look at them, but the point is they provide jobs. And the point is, it's been proven over time that it will help the economy. It will grow Oregon, and it will make a huge difference long term, not only in our revenue, but in our prosperity as a whole. So I would just say to you that when we look at this, don't look at one study, but look at the results in other states. Look at the results nationally. Look at the results from different people from different schools of thought that have said this cut in capital gains will work. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions for either Mr. Cannon or Mr. Schweinert? Representative Galizio.
I have a question for Joe.
Yes, sir.
Because the information about the OTIM model, I didn't know that background. I didn't know the background about the OTIM model, how it was all that, although perhaps in the orientation it was explained to me. But so AOI, you were there. At the sort of the genesis of the creation of the OTIM model. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leo, no, I was not.
Were representatives from AOI there,
yes,
and part of the work group that created OTIM? No. I'm just...
Mr. Chairman, right. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So here we're left with the OTIM model saying... The cost per job, if it creates 4,128 jobs, is $32,280 per job. And Mr. Connerly's study is $321 per job. What are we supposed to do with that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galizio, the best way I can answer that is, like we said, we can look at six different studies, and we can probably get a lot of different answers. I can't speak for Mr. Connerly's study. Like I said, I wish he was here. But it's my understanding OTIM can't always register those things, can't register everything when they look at all the numbers that go into this. My only other answer with this to be, look at the other states that are doing this. Look at the other states that have been cutting these rates. Look at the other states that have been successful in doing this and in making it work. If this is a way to do it, why doesn't everybody have high capital gains? It just makes sense that when you cut capital gains, from what we've seen from experiences and from studies, that it does work and it does cost less per job.
Thank you.
Representative Hess, recognized.
Thank you. On that point, Joe, we've talked about this before and how California has a higher capital gains tax rate and yet is the venture capital of the world, has a technology sector second to none, and yet they have a higher capital gains rate. When Bill Connerly was here, and I've known him for a long time, and I think he's a good man, but the one question that we asked him on how do you guarantee that any of these capital gains savings will be reinvested into the Oregon economy, he did concede, yes, that's a problem. And to me, that's what this all boils down to, is if somebody's going to save $20,000 in capital gains and then go to Wall Street and buy 10,000 shares of IBM, that doesn't help Oregon. And that, to me, that's the essence of this entire debate.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hess, I don't think he termed it as a problem. I think he termed it as, yes, on situations like this, you can't guarantee those type things. You can't. But when his studies showed, and I don't want to go into the study here, showed that there is a return, when he put the numbers into his model, he showed there is a return on investment. That's why there were jobs. That's why he could point to jobs. That's why he showed that the jobs were less cost. And, you know, so the return was there. It's just it's difficult to say for sure it's going to happen. I mean, when I hear people talk about we're possibly taking some of this on faith and we're putting money into the capital gains cut and we're saying, you know, this will make a difference. To some degree, we're doing the same thing with education. We're putting money into education. We're saying we're going to educate our kids and we're going to make them successful. But when they graduate from college, there's no guarantee on anything. But we're going to make it happen because we have faith. We know it's going to work. So that's what we're doing here. We can look at the experience of other kids going through school and becoming successful and helping themselves, helping the economy. The capital gains is the same way. The experiences say it will work. The studies say it will work. And that's what we're trying to do. I only wish Dr. Connolly were here to answer that question directly.
And Representative Hass, after what happened to IBM this past week, I don't know if that's a good but I will say that since it has happened, the yield on the dividend from IBM is for that person that took that $20,000 and invested in IBM, the yield is actually pretty good, and they're going to pay ordinary income tax on that. The only way that I think Oregon loses in that process is if they sell that property and leave the state. But if they're going to do that, it almost is better for them to leave the state and then sell the property, because then they're not going to pay the tax, at least to Oregon. And if they move to California and pay a higher rate, or if they move to California and get a 50% reduction, an exclusion of their capital gains, or a reduction in their capital gains rate. I guess another portion of the testimony that's been a little confusing to me is that we've got people moving into the metropolitan area and to Portland with lots and lots of money. Well, where are they moving into? They're not moving in there from Eastern Oregon, I can tell you that, with that kind of money. So they must be coming from somewhere else. Oregon must be a great place to come. And I'm looking at that and I'm saying, bring them on. And to the extent that we get folks that can afford these $300,000 to $500,000 homes, I'm anxious that those folks move in here in the truckloads and busloads. I really am. Well, Mark, did you have a follow up on that? Excuse me. Go ahead, Mark.
Representative. Mr. Chair, I mean that is happening. They are moving up here, and they are moving up here with the capital gains rate the way it is. I mean, there is a net in-migration to Oregon, and Population Research Center of Portland State says the biggest reason is because of the relatively cheap housing that Oregon has compared to the Bay Area of California.
That's great.
And so those people are moving.
They may have also
heard, capital gains.
Yeah, they may have also heard that we were considering 2574 and 20.
They may have also heard that we have a state pairs are approved. So.
Mr. Chairman, it also may be still, we talked about trying to narrow this to the point of where the capital gain rate goes to Oregonians that invest in Oregon. In 2004, there were $18.2 billion invested across the U.S. by venture capitalists. Only $99 million went to Oregon. What this bill would do, if we were to make that change, is why would people invest in Oregon from outside the state? I think we need that investment here. So we certainly don't want to limit what possibilities can be. One other question I have, Mr. Chairman, is there a fiscal on any of these possible amendments to 2574?
Yes, there are, and the concern that I've had is in meeting with the Department of Revenue, even the smallest of those that are currently in play, if we start to modify, and I'm particularly Representative Galizio, I don't want to don't want to shoot your dog in front of you.
Go ahead.
But I'm concerned about the fiscals on amendments 1, 2, and 3. Concerned about the schedules that would have to be created in order to identify Oregon tangible and personal property and real property, as well as the Department of Revenue adopting rules to trace the net capital gains that would be taxable under 3, and then the schedules that would be required to limit capital gains on just the first 2,000. In meeting with the Department of Revenue, that's one of the concerns that we had with originally with 2332 was that it had rather considerable fiscal impact just to identify capital gains as a separate item off of the federal tax return, let alone make any manipulations on the capital gains.
So. Yeah, I think that's a legitimate concern and needs to be looked at, but I think we're not inventing this. I mean, there's a model out there that exists, and it's not going to cost $133 million. And I just have to respond to, you know, you made the analogy with education is at some level, there's no guarantee. And at one level, you're right. But I think there is empirical proof that people who do achieve higher levels of education just do better economically, and ultimately it is better. So I just, that comparison.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I couldn't agree with you more. And it's the same with cutting the capital gains. Mm-hmm. You will see the effect.
Thank you very much. Representative Riley is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to ask you about the amendments because I know you haven't had a chance to look at those. But what I am going to ask you is, and I don't have it in front of me, but have you seen the charts that I did see, which would show the richest to the poorest states in personal wealth, and the distribution on that chart of who had the highest and the lowest capital gains tax. What I saw was in the top 10 there were some with very high capital gains tax and very low capital gains tax down to zero, and in the bottom 10. There was the same distribution. And what that leads me to believe is that although I can see empirically the results of students coming out of higher education and doing better, I cannot see, based on what I have seen in those charts, the results of anything resulting from difference in capital gains.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley. I don't remember the chart offhand. I'd have to look at it again.
You need to.
But I would think if you're going to look at capital gains and you're going to compare it to education, then you probably need to look at the university systems in those states also.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Kahn?
Joe, my question is just a little broader. I know kind of in my mind what I'm going to ask you, but I want to know your answer to this. What's your definition of a successful state? You said the most successful states. What's your definition? What's a successful state look like to you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cobb, when I was talking about that as a successful state, I was talking about economically. When you take a state, and the only one pops in my head right now is Texas.
Right.
That has zero capital gains. That is doing exceptionally well with getting investment brought into the state with jobs and moving ahead. That's the type of thing I was looking at.
Okay.
Their unemployment's down. There are a tremendous amount of investment there. And there's probably two or three others that are just right up there on the top that are moving economically along very well in the sputtering.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. For the questions? Thank you very much. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you,
Mike. I appreciate it. We've badgered you folks on enough, both those pro and con. Let me just ask staff. I thought I recalled, And I need to know this relative to the OTM that we're using. I thought I recalled that during the special sessions of 2002, we had an income drop in capital gains of something in the vicinity of 84% from over $800 million collected in personal capital gains down to something in the vicinity of $100 million. Does that number ring a bell to anybody, or is that just part of a bad dream? I know that it was part of a bad dream.
It's in here. It's in history.
Mr. Chair, Paul Warner, unless they have any. You're right, Mr. Chair, about the initial estimates of the capital gains reductions were in the neighborhood of 80%. One of the things we learned from that experience is our capital gains data does come in with more of a lag than the other sources of income, and I believe our loss ended up being right around 54%.
I see.
So it was basically cut in half, a little more than half. Okay. Not quite as severe as we had initially thought. I think that's the number you're thinking about was our initial estimate.
Was 84%.
When we just had partial returns. And this, in fact, has affected, we built that into Lisbeth's revenue impact analysis that we often see the capital gains effect in the extended returns that are filed in September of the following year.
Okay. At that time, Paul, my recollection was that we did have some work groups on trying to seek stabilized funding and the tax system, a basic review of the tax system and stabilized education funding. One of the comments and one of the things we worked on, or at least discussed, was the fact that maybe we shouldn't be quite as dependent upon capital gains to remove remove that factor from this overall formula. Are we projecting that capital gains are really going to increase back when we've dropped 50%+ actual drop? Are we projecting, how long will it take us to recover that 50%+, Paul?
Elizabeth, I believe we get there right about 2011, right at the end of the forecast horizon.
Okay. So 2011, we're back up to where we were before the bubble.
Where we were in the year 2000.
Okay.
And I think the state economist has made this pretty clear in his presentations to you that, you know, that is one of the most difficult components of AGI to predict, and certainly we've learned historically the most volatile.
Okay. Paul, presently my understanding, and maybe Elizabeth, this is a question you can answer, the present capital gains tax rates, we no longer have exclusion for federal capital gains as we used to do, but the current rate actually has a separate rate chart on the back of Schedule D, as I recall, alternative capital gains rate. Are those the maximum rate 15%? Is that right? Okay, and the maximum ordinary rate, as I recall, was what, 30? Is it up 35 with a surtax? 32 plus 3.2. Is that what? And I'm sorry, I don't practice. Representative Riley, what does Riley and Associates do with regard to the 32% bracket, other than trying to avoid it, that bracket?
We've never been there.
Oh, okay.
We don't have to worry about it.
I'm trying to remember if isn't the marginal the upper. I know that there's a 28%, and then I thought it jumped up to 32, and then a 10% surtax, a 3.2 surtax. So it's between 32 and 35%, as I recall.
I thought it was 33.
33? Okay. And maybe that's 33 plus a 10%.
Are you trying to get at the differential?
I'm trying to compare what we're doing from the 33% for 15% maximum capital gains at federal level versus Oregon's 9% versus where part of the discussion is here today on the dash 4 and 5 amendments that we'll have Elizabeth discuss. And those would bring us back to a 4.5% rate on a 9% rate versus a 15% maximum rate on capital gains on federal versus a 33 upper. So it's a little less than 50%. So if you were to put that in the form of an exclusion, it would be in excess of 50% exclusion.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Colleagues, let's see. We also then had on, because we're in a public hearing, on 2332 as well, or 2574, I believe. Let's see, 2332 has the dash 4 and 5 amendments. Elizabeth, you want to just tell us about those dash 4 and dash 5 amendments?
Yeah. Chairman Butler and committee members, you also have a summary sheet, just so you're clear, on House Bill 2332. I've gone through already the first three, and those were what Representative Galizio was talking about with House Bill 2574. And then if you look on the second page there, there's the -4 amendment, the -5. So the -4 amendment was addressing some of the issues that Chairman Butler was raising about some of the fiscal concerns. And so this is basically the same as House Bill 2574 as far as the revenue impact. It just is creating a different type of capital gains tax reduction. It's creating a capital gains tax subtraction in Oregon, and then does that for personal income tax as well as capital gains. So it's beginning in tax year 2007, where originally in House Bill 2574, it was beginning in tax year 2006. This begins it in 2007. And what you have is a percent reduction. So you're just going to have then a line item in which would be a subtraction from taxable income of 6% of the net capital gains incurred by Oregon personal income tax taxpayers in 2007, and then it's phased up. So in 2008, it's 17% net capital gains deduction. And then in 2009, it's 28%. In 2010, it's 39%. And then in 2011 and beyond, it's a 50% net capital gains subtraction. So that's the same thing as what you were doing before when you went from the 9% under current law down to 4.5%. And that's how these percentages were figured. We're basically just looking at that percent reduction in the tax rate under the current bill. And then what you're also doing there is, again, giving a choice to those personal income tax payers who also may have the option of claiming a lower capital gains tax rate of 5% for farm property, so they can choose which one they want to have, whether they want to have a subtraction or they want to have the 5% capital gains tax rate. And that's beginning January 1st, 2007, the same as the rest of the bill. Then when you look at the corporate portion, then those start in tax year 2008 and not in 2007. And then that's a subtraction of 2%, which again was going with the same tax rate reduction schedule that was in the original bill of 2574. So you had a 2% reduction there in 2008. 2009, you had 17%. And in 2010, unfortunately, this is another little just error in legislative council drafting, but they went down to 50%. Originally in House Bill 2574, you only went down to 4.5% tax rate for both corporations and personal income tax filers, and that wouldn't have been a reduction of 50% from a 6.6%. That would only have been a reduction of 32%. So this was supposed to be 32%, but it got in there as 50%. So that's what you have in the bill. And then this is all beginning January 1st, 2008. So basically that's what the -4 is doing. And then with the -5, this is the exact same amendment as the -4 with this subtraction now, and not a tax rate, capital gains tax rate reduction, but a subtraction. And the same percentages, only they're beginning them sooner. So this begins the personal income tax subtraction in 2005, and it goes at 6%. And then in 2006, it's 17%, 2007, 28%, 2008, 39%, and then by 2009, 50%. And then you see again the same issue with being allowed the same subtraction for farm property if the taxpayer chooses that. And then this begins the capital gains tax subtraction, not in 2008, but then it begins it here in 2005. So it begins at the same year as the personal income tax. And then again, the rates are 2%, then it goes to 17%, and then 50%.
And that would leave an effective capital gains rate in a corporation at
3.3% instead of the 4.5%.
Which is a 50% rate
reduction.
It's
a 50% rate reduction. I just want to clarify that I didn't put it in there that way intentionally. I just, that's the way it came out of council, and that is a change from your original bill, what we were trying to follow. So then with your revenue impacts, I gave you one for each one of the amendments. Let's see. I can just briefly say that like the -1 again, which was the first 2,000 of net capital gains is exempt, that that is beginning in tax year 2006. So we're seeing a portion of that in 2006-07, and then an additional amount where we're assuming that 75% of that comes in the following year, in like April of the following year, and then additional 25%, because capital gains capital gains tax can be paid in up to October each year, which is an extension from the April filing period that most personal income tax returns have to abide by. So anyway, with the Dash 1 amendment, the revenue impact for 2005-07 biennium is a reduction of $5.4 million, and then by 2007-09 biennium, $24 million, and then by 2009-11, $26 million. So there isn't really a phase in. It's just this first year you're not getting the full impact of one particular year. So that's why that's smaller to begin with. Then when you look at the Dash 2 amendment, which was just real similar to the Dash 1, except for it was 4.5% tax rate, then that was a reduction of $3 million, and then by 2007-09 biennium, a reduction of $13.6 million, and then in 2009-11, $14 million. And then the Dash 3 amendment, it is more difficult to try to quantify, and this is the Colorado example, in trying to determine exactly how much capital gain we're seeing on property just in Oregon and for the stocks and other ownership interests just for businesses here in Oregon. What I did was I looked at what Colorado had as far as the what portion of their total capital gains were these capital gains in Colorado, and it was right at about 20%. So that's what I used then as far as a proxy for how much could potentially be a subtraction and at that reduced rate of 4.5%. And since this wasn't a complete exemption, then I just looked at only half of it being actually exempt. So these numbers are definitely, you know, something that's would be nice if we had some additional data to be able to look at specifically Oregon and our own capital gains, but that's a huge study that would take months to do. So basically with this, just looking at the Colorado experience, we see a reduction then of about $10.8 million, and then in 2007-09 biennium, $48 million, and then by 2009-11 biennium, $56.8 million. So that's where that Dash 3 revenue impact comes from. Now when we're moving to the Dash 4 and Dash 5, these two, again, have the subtraction, but the Dash 4, it's different than your original House Bill 2574 revenue impact, because it starts in 2007. And just so everyone's clear, too, I also put in the dynamic feedback effects from the OTM run, and then I incorporated that into your revenue loss estimate. So you have not only a portfolio effect, meaning the additional increased realizations from having a lower capital gains tax rate, but then you also have these dynamic feedback effects. So that's what's incorporated into all these revenue impacts I've just been describing. So you have here in 2000, with this Dash 4 amendment, you're beginning the revenue loss in 2007-08, and then that is a reduction of $7.4 million, and then by 2008-09, it's $41 million. And so for this 2007-09 biennium, $48.6 million, and then by the 2009-11 biennium, $218.2 million as a revenue loss. And then if you look at the Dash 5, again, it's exact same schedule, only it's just starting it sooner. So then you see a reduction here with the Dash 5 amendments in 2005-06 of $11 million, and in 2006-07 of $38.7 million, and then for the 2005-07 biennium, $50 million. And then in the outer bienniums, 2007-09 biennium, $188 million, mm-hmm. and then the 2009-11 biennium, $354.4 million.
Elizabeth, the $133.7 million, and that's, I assume that's okay, the static that's shown on the Dash 4.
Nope. No, in the dashboard, I've included everything in there.
Okay.
I can write that better so it's clear. But, yes, I do have, I've got the static, then I add in the portfolio effects from having the lower
okay.
tax rate, and then I add in the dynamic feedback effects, and that's
okay.
the end result.
Okay. Questions of staff regarding the legislative revenue, fiscal impact, revenue impact.
The dash 4 and 5.
Yeah, it probably wouldn't hurt to have Deborah Buchanan come forward because, Deborah, you and I have discussed with Legislative Revenue Office information that probably should be shared with the members relative to some of the costs. And in that regard, we were expending one of the other items that we've discussed today was the rent credit and those kinds of things relative to the earlier bill 2046 and the information you gave me, I think, was that we were expending, what was it, $600,000 was the fiscal impact back when we took the HARP HARP tax off or that revenue reduction at that time. So can you just give us kind of an update of the fiscal on these issues?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, you're correct that I believe it was 1990 we projected a savings of around $600,000 from the elimination of the homeowner and renter relief program, which went away at that time. We did do a very rough calculation of what it might cost to institute a new low-income renter assistance program, and the numbers there were a little over $1 million to set up a new program for that. The fiscal impact for a refundable earned income credit we estimated to be slightly over $200,000. So that would be House Bill 2046. I know there were amendments to move that to the 2007-09 biennium. The programming for that was modeled on the existing refundable working family child care credit. Mr. Chairman, to the capital gains provisions, we did talk with you about the fiscal impact for House Bill 2574, which would require a separate tax calculation for capital gains, and that did have a significant fiscal impact, over $400,000. To do that, and what you need to keep in mind is that it really requires two separate tax calculations, and as drafted, when it phases in the reduction, what you're doing really is running your calculations twice on each return because you're comparing whether you have a lower tax using the regular rates versus what you would have with a reduced capital gains rate. So a person who's in the marginal bracket of 7% would actually pay less tax using that bracket than they would 8.5%. So during that phase-in period, that's when there are significant costs. Changing it to a subtraction, which some of the amendments do, makes it simpler because you're not then doing two calculations. You're just doing a calculation to come up with a subtraction. For the amendments to House Bill 2332, Mr. Chairman, if I could just take those one at a time, the Dash 1 amendment actually might not have a very significant fiscal impact because you have up to a $2,000 subtraction. If that were claimed just as another subtraction on the Oregon return, there would not be significant programming costs for that, and that might actually have a lower fiscal even though it's implemented in this biennium. The Dash 2 amendment would have a larger fiscal impact because then you have that, again, you have those two calculations that you're doing. You're comparing your regular tax versus a 4.5% tax. And the difficulty with the Dash 2 amendment is you have the farmers with a 5% rate who could use the 4.5% rate. So you're going to have a worksheet, and you're going to have some calculations there that would have to take place. So that has a larger fiscal cost than the Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 3 amendment, I'm thinking, would have a much larger fiscal cost than the Dash 2 amendment, because the department would be trying to identify the type of capital gain that qualifies for this reduced rate.
Representative Galizio?
Well, I just because not everyone was in here, so I know it's, I don't know if you, Department of Revenue does ballpark, but so for the, you said the Dash, I mean, so for the Dash 2 amendment on 2332, can you, it's easier for me, some kind of a number or a range, so I have an idea, because expensive, I don't know what that means, it costs a lot.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galizio, what decreases the cost for this is that you go directly to a 4.5% rate. You don't phase it down. So that makes it less expensive than moving from 9 to 8.5 to 7.5 to 6.5 to 5.5.
Yeah, okay.
What increases this is that farmers can use a capital gains rate of 5% on long-term capital gain. They would be able to use 4.5% on net capital gain, and those aren't necessarily the same two dollar amounts. So because of that, you would have to go to a worksheet and run through a series of calculations to determine whether you have a lower tax under one method than what you would have under the other method. It would be less costly for us to implement if you simply said the farmers have to do one or the other, but they can't do both, and that's what you see in the 4 and 5 amendments. Okay. So there is a way to reduce the complexity, but it's not here in these amendments.
Thank you.
And again, the Dash 3, because you are trying to identify certain types of gain that are going to be treated differently, and we would have to tell taxpayers what those gains are, and how they identify them, that has a larger fiscal impact than either of the other two, because you're looking at trying to capture what real or tangible personal property located in this state at the time of sale, stocks or other ownership interests in an entity primarily located in the state. Those things are going to need definition communicated to taxpayers as to what qualifies and so on, and all of that takes effort to do. The Dash 4 and the Dash 5 amendments, Mr. Chair, the Dash 4, because they move those to 0709 biennium, and because you are dealing with a subtraction from income and not a different tax rate calculation, has less of a cost for us to implement. We do believe, however, that we would need to have a worksheet for the taxpayers to fill out, because there would be a significant number of taxpayers taking this subtraction, which could be a fairly large subtraction, so we want to make sure that they're doing it correctly. And that would entail some costs. We, again, had that around $200,000, $250,000 to do the programming to set this up in that outer biennium. And the Dash 5 amendment cost would be similar to the Dash 4 amendment, but it would be in the 05-07 biennium that we would incur those costs to implement that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? I'm sorry that I didn't hear the answer on the Dash 5. The Dash 5, the fiscal cost of the Dash 5, which is accelerating it into the current year, I think, isn't Representative Hass, that would have a fiscal on it of how much, do you thought, Deborah?
Roughly, Mr. Chair, between $200,000 and $250,000.
Okay. Further questions of Deborah from the Department?
Can't get a roughly on the other ones? Can't do, just can't. It's impossible. Just please say it's impossible.
Mr. Chair, Representative Felizio, I'm sorry. I had an opportunity to work with staff on the Dash 4 and the Dash 5, and I didn't have that opportunity on the others. But
Okay. Yeah, no.
I would hate to commit program to something and then have to eat my words.
Okay. Yep. All right.
suffice to say,
less than
expensive.
It's less than the cost of a home in West Medford, according to yesterday's testimony.
Thank you very much, Chairman. Appreciate it. You've got a series of questions here on the Elizabeth on the revenue impact on the dash on the 3223. And let's see, the 3223 was
that was the original bill,
right? Yeah. The original bill, which was to drop it
to five,
and so at 2007-2009. It was dropping it down to 7.5 to 5.5, mm-hmm. and the cost was $154 million. And on the dash five was to bring it down 2007-2009 would be to bring it to the equivalent capital gains reduction.
Okay. And just to clarify, so first of all, this House Bill 2332, original one, does not include the dynamic impacts. Okay, so I've got the dynamic impacts in here, in the dash five and the dash four.
Dash five and four.
Okay, so that they're not included in that one. That one I put the portfolio, right. But I didn't have
this
the OTM
static.
Run done.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So static and dynamic.
Sorry,
God. Thank you very much.
Okay. That was a test, Jim.
well, you're confusing me.
We're still sorting it out. Colleagues, we're set for a work session on these bills tomorrow, and I don't think we have a full quorum here tomorrow or a full panel here tomorrow. And I forget to tell you that after suffering from headaches for the last 3 weeks, the doctors are telling me that I've got to be in the hospital tomorrow morning. So with that, I may not even be here tomorrow afternoon. So, colleagues, we may move this over until Monday again, and I apologize. They said it was just an in-hospital procedure, and then they called this morning and said he's got to do this before he comes in for surgery tomorrow. So with that, colleagues, I apologize that I'll have to be out tomorrow. And I don't know how long. My hope is I would be back by noon or 1 o'clock. But I'm anxious about continuing the work session. Representative Boquist.
Mr. I have a funeral to attend tomorrow afternoon too.
Okay, thank you. And I understand that Representative Felice or Representative Esquivel.
His name, whatever.
Yeah.
Yes, I shall be gone. A good friend of mine, Danny Miles, is the head coach at OIT. Last year, of course, they became the national champions, and he has been chosen as the graduate of the year for Southern Oregon College, which is now SOU. So we're having a big function for him.
With that, colleagues, we appreciate your attendance here today, and we anticipate posting a work session on Monday for these as well. So with that, we will close the public hearing on 2574 and 2332, and we will close revenue for the day. Thank you very much.